This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 Joycast. In this Joycast, you'll hear a summary of the weekly program. Due to copyright restrictions, the music has been edited to make this Joycast possible. For more information about the music played during the show, please visit the blog at joy.org.au/The Fool and the Opera.
Good evening and welcome to another episode of The Fool and the Opera, the show where we like to mix things up a bit and present you opera in its strangest and most entertaining form as possible. Pretty good considering, you know, it is an entertaining art form to start off with anyway. Now, on today's show, I just want to put it out there, don't want to affect anybody, you know, sending in messages or anything like that, but hey, it is my birthday week, so... If you'd like to help me celebrate it, you can certainly do so by texting into 0427-JOY-949. You can email onair@joy.org.au. There's also Jerry out there, Moonwalking Jerry, I always like to call him, out there on the phone, so you can give him a call on 9699-2949. And, well, I thought that in sort of celebration of my birthday, I might start with a track with a performer that I just adore. And it's, you know, self-indulgent, but hey, that's how radio goes sometimes. But I'm sure you'll enjoy it too. Now, the singer is Katie Noonan. And the interesting part about this particular track is she'll be singing with her mother, Maggie Noonan, who's a very well-known opera singer who sang with the Opera Queensland for quite a while. And it comes from an album where they've sung together and it's with the Opera Queensland Orchestra. And it's from the album called Two of a Kind. And I've just decided to pick a track called The Letter Duet. Sull'aria c'è suave zeffiretto is what I believe it's called. And, well, I'll tell you what it's all about after the song. But I do hope you enjoy it. And close your eyes and, you know, enjoy the indulgent music that we'll be playing tonight. And, of course, actually, I should mention also that we've got an interview with Brett Sheehy coming up as well. So it's definitely worth sticking around. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. On The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9, and we just played Sull'aria c'è suave zeffiretto, which is from The Marriage of Figaro, which is quite an apt little tune to be playing for today because marriage will pop up before the end of the show once more again in the context of gay marriage, actually. And we spoke about that because we spoke with Brett Sheehy this week about the upcoming Melbourne International Arts Festival, which is a very exciting, you know, Melbourne Festival is one of those big times in Melbourne when we get all sorts of great shows coming to town. And this year, there's three shows that have a bit of an operatic slant to them. So we had a chat with him, of course, about all that sort of stuff. And, I think we might get right into it today. We'll just start playing the interview so that you can, enjoy. Now, there's going to be a bit of music in between this particular interview that is quite amazing. It's from Sasha Waltz's Medea, and it's a very ear-catching tune, shall we say. So I'll play the interview now with Brett Sheehy. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. Brett Sheehy is one of the most acclaimed and certainly most accomplished artistic directors in this country. Two Adelaide festivals, four Sydney festivals, and now his first Melbourne festival. We're going to chat today with Brett about the fun and festivities and, of course, the trials and tribulations as well. So thanks for joining me, Brett.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
Now, Richard Gill, who's an artistic director for the Victorian Opera, has said that being an artistic director is not a democratic process because somebody has to cop the flak.
Yeah. I believe in that really strongly. One of the things that a lot of people in the arts shy away from is ever making a judgment call and actually finally saying, you know, this is good or this is bad or this is memorable memorable or this is forgettable. But finally, that's the job. I mean, the buck stops with me. Everything on our stages, I'm responsible for. And so, you know, that kind of benchmark of excellence, I think, has to be met by every single element of the program.
And so having done Adelaide and Sydney and now Melbourne, what's your vision for Melbourne?
Yeah, look, it kind of happens organically as I've moved from city to city. I guess the things that separate or that kind of define the vision for a particular city are both the artistic community of that city. So, you know, for the first time, I'm getting to work with, you know, Melbourne Symphony Orchestra. I'm getting to work with Melbourne Theatre Company. I'm getting to work with visual artists. Chunky Move I'm working with, I've worked with them before. But actually being part of that kind of, you know, cultural fabric of the city itself is fantastic. A lot of my favourite artists in the world actually reside in Melbourne. So to actually have the opportunity now to be here on the ground with them and develop work or you know, kind of commission work with them is a terrific opportunity. The other thing that defines it, I think, really is the topography of the city itself. And I so believe that festivals ought to be a visible part of their city's landscape. And what we've created now, what's being created for us in that whole South Bank precinct, and including development over the next 5 years, I honestly believe it's going to be arguably the best festival precinct in the world. The reason being, there will be somewhere between 45 and 50 venues within 1 square kilometre, all walkable from venue to venue, all on a kind of flat landscape. And that's just a dream come true in a festival context. So I'm kind of, you know, thrilled to bits now to be able to exploit that, I guess, for Melbourne and create, you know, a kind of, you know, amazing festival in that precinct.
Well, let's talk about the topography of Melbourne then. Is that going to be the main point of difference between Melbourne and Adelaide and Sydney?
Yeah, look, Pete, I don't know. It's probably not best for me to judge the points of difference. Only because, I mean, it's kind of the Paul Thomas Anderson thing, the film director. I mean, how different is Boogie Nights from There Will Be Blood? So entirely different, because it's different locations in a filmic sense, different script, different performers, different time in history when you're presenting the work. All of that, I think, is much more significant than trying to actually crystallize down, oh, Melbourne is this kind of city, Adelaide is that kind of city, Sydney is that kind of city. I mean, finally, I have found in moving around the country, and I was actually born and bred in Brisbane, so this is my fourth cultural experience of a capital city. And finally, people are people, and they will respond to great art no matter where they are. And so I kind of keep focused on that, but then bring the physicality of the city into that mix and then also the cultural landscape. But that's my starting point. Mm. And every festival I've ever presented is vastly different from the previous one for those kind of, you know, filmic reasons, different location, different script, different performers, bang, bang, bang. Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the scripts and the performances.
Sure.
Because I think about 90% of this program is exclusive to Melbourne.
Yeah.
Is that what it means to have all these different performances from Melbourne?
That's really important to me. The reason being, I think cultural tourism, for want of a better phrase, is really significant. I don't want what's presented in Melbourne's festival to be just part of a national touring circuit. I don't want people in Sydney or Brisbane or Adelaide and Perth to just look at the program and think, oh, that's coming here next week, or that was here last week. I actually want the people of Australia and indeed the region to actually get on aeroplanes or buses and cars and trains and travel to Melbourne for Melbourne's festival. So that's a really important thing for me, that exclusivity, and to actually concentrate the work in this city for the duration of the festival. For Australian work, of course, I'm thrilled for it to then go out and have a life beyond the presentation in Melbourne. But for many of those key international works, where, in fact, you know, they can perform any time of the year, they get invitations constantly, I want the only place in Australia or the region they perform, by and large, to be in Melbourne.
And would, for example, Medea be one of those?
Absolutely.
That's coming at the moment?
And yeah, look, Sasha Volz, I mean, I think I can say this, three other cities in Australia, you know, begged us to take Sasha either before or after her presentations in Melbourne. And we, you know, politely declined. And they understood that you know, exclusivity is important. And a festival is a special thing. It's not just, you know, a truck and bus roadshow. It ought to be special to the city in which it's presented.
And this production sounds quite special. It's called a dance opera, and there's no doof-doof. It's actually got amazing choreography in it.
No doof doof. True. Yeah, look. Sasha's an extraordinary artist. She began in the dance world. And certainly over her first kind of, you know, maybe 10 years as an artist, it was exclusively dance. But then probably about 3 years ago, she started to look at opera and obviously, you know, bringing the musicality of her dance into a very musical medium. And she's now creating these works, which are dance operas. I mean, essentially they're operas, but all of the work from start to finish right through is choreographed, which is not new to the world of opera. I mean, opera began with dance being an integral part of it centuries ago. However, in terms of the contemporary opera landscape, it is very unusual. And I think what she does, therefore, I mean, holistically, it's pulling all of those elements of art together to create one extraordinary moment and borrowing from everywhere. I mean, they're actually moving image elements to this production. There are dance elements, theatre elements, obviously musical elements as well. So, yeah, I don't know if you've heard the term, you know, Gesamtkunstwerk, which was the term applied to a lot of Wagner's work, the holistic artistic experience. And I think Sasha absolutely is achieving that, perhaps uniquely in the world at the moment.
Mm. What was your response to it when you first saw it?
Saw her work? Mm. God, a really interesting response. I first saw her work in the year 2000, and frankly, I don't think I was ready for it. I found it so incredibly boundary-breaking. It was a pure dance work, but it was like nothing I'd ever seen before. And I don't feel at the time, actually, I was skilled up enough to appreciate what I was seeing. That said, the next day I woke up and I could not get it out of my head. Same thing the next week, the next month, and so on. Then in 2003, I think, I finally worked up the courage to invite her to Australia. I'd fallen in love with her work by then. She was just so busy, it was impossible. And look, the truth is, you know, that has been a standing invitation to her for the past 6 years. In that time, she's had probably a dozen invitations from elsewhere in Australia as well. But this is the first time, happily, that you know, she's been able to bring the company here, and it's for Melbourne, so I'm thrilled.
Is that a difficult thing when you're an artistic director of a festival to kind of go see productions outside? Are you constantly just ticking the back of your brain, kind of going, oh, this could work for the festival?
Constantly. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's impossible to look at any. It's impossible now, I guess, for me after 25 years in the arts and you know, 14 years in festival land, to look at any art form and not look at it through the eyes of, you know, how could this work in a festival context? And one of the things I try to do always is to look at work through the eyes of the audience as well as through the eyes of the artistic director. So try to experience the work, how an audience will experience it first time on the ear or on the eyes, and then kind of assemble the program with all of that.
But does it ruin your experience when you go see other shows?
You know, maybe it does. I mean, certainly I'm most relaxed in the cinema because that's one, even though now we're presenting a film program and I hope to grow that over the next few years. But yeah, that's kind of one space in which I can completely let go and I suppose let my judgment go. Mm. And maybe that leads me to, you know, really enjoy sometimes pretty trivial work. I mean, I actually, you know, love you know, action films. And I saw September Issue on the weekend and just thought every frame of it was perfection. Yeah. But I can't say it's a, you know, cinematic masterpiece. But yeah, so ruin's a funny word. I mean, on one level, it enhances any artistic experience because I now have this kind of backstory of, you know, history of the art form plus knowledge about the work, which enriches the experience to some extent. But yeah, it does mean that, you know, art purely for entertainment's sake is pretty well off the agenda for me.
But it does sound like you've got a very different taste in your personal life as opposed to what you put on in the festival.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. But yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I think everyone has incredibly eclectic taste. You know, I think anyone can enjoy you know, high opera, and the same people will always have pop songs they love as well. Mm. So I don't think that's kind of, certainly not unique to me, although I have made a conscious attempt in all of my arts life since I joined Sydney Theatre Company in 1985 to always keep a kind of anchor in, for want of a better phrase, the real world. And nearly all of my friends and my social milieu tend not to be from the arts world. They just tend to be, you know, girls and guys I went to uni with who are, you know, lawyers or pharmacists or, you know, restaurateurs, whatever. Mm. That's much more the social world I move in because I'm kind of immersed in art, I suppose, almost 24/7 work-wise.
And know? I think you do come from a lawyer family and
yeah.
your partner's a chef. Is that why some of those connections are being made?
Probably. I guess at least I understand those worlds. I kind of, you know, vaguely understand the world of law. And I studied law for a little while, disastrously. I dropped out 3 times over 7 years. And, you know, my partner is a chef, so you know, he's kind of, you know, taught me to understand chefdom and restauranteuring. So, yeah, I guess there's a link there.
I suppose it's useful as well, being in the arts, to have people who are connected to the money as well. Where, you know,
yeah, no,
to bring them in.
That's very true, because God knows none of us are paid extraordinary salaries. So, yeah, look, I'm sure it doesn't hurt in terms of, you know, philanthropy and patrons and corporate sponsors to actually have a life outside our kind of sometimes cloistered world of the arts.
Can we talk a bit about the funding of the festival?
Yeah.
Because it's one of the interesting things. A lot of it comes from, what is it? It's Victorian...
Yeah, State Government, Arts Victoria.
Right. So how does that work for the organisation in terms of relying on that government funding to make it happen?
Yeah, God. It's, I mean, our three, you know, our three funding streams are State Government, sponsorship and philanthropy, and then box office. They're the three key ones. I'm with State Government, local government as well. So government, corporate and philanthropy, and then box office. Look, it's I don't know how strange it is or how difficult, because it's the world I grew up in. I mean, since, you know, joining, you know, Sydney Theatre Company, subsidised company in 1985, that's what I've always known. But, you know, I do think that there are certain kind of, you know, scientific, if you like, balancing acts to be made there. There is an art to generating revenue as much as there is an art to putting together a program. I want to grow Melbourne's festival significantly. I, at the moment, in terms of the amount of money we have to spend on the art, we're fourth in line in the country. I'd love to be number one. And so that means kind of, you know, building attendances, building box office, building relationships with corporate Melbourne. And you know, with philanthropy and patrons. I have to say, my first port of call is not government for additional funding. I think we're, you know, well-funded and generously funded. I'd rather look elsewhere to grow the festival. And that's, over the past 12 months, we've done that. I mean, amazingly, despite the global financial crisis, sponsorship is up by 20% on last year. If I can put it up another 20% next year and 20% the year after, I think we'll be going gangbusters.
I think it was on your Twitter that I actually read that you posed the question, what global financial crisis? There was a festival overseas that was doing really well.
Yeah, Manchester. Yeah. Just sold out performances left, right and centre. And yet, you know, the UK obviously has been hit much more severely than Australia, and yet still, you know, their festival was going off. And Edinburgh, which is just about to finish, I think has done terrific business as well. I mean, you know, I don't want to be cavalier about this, but, you know, if the art is great, you know, people will come. And I think in the my understanding is in the kind of pre-Andrew Lloyd Webber, Tim Rice world, that up until that point, that the best box office ever done on the West End in history was all through the Second World War. So even in those perilous times, people were desperate to be kind of, you know, inspired and moved and challenged by art.
I suppose it's the thing. In the darkest times, you rely on art to uplift you, I suppose.
I think so. Yeah. And you know, I'm not a religious person, but, you know, it does have, in some ways, I think, a spiritual dimension. I mean, I think you can be transformed. And I think, you know, transformative experiences are always fantastic.
So it sounds like art is your religion, isn't it?
Maybe. Yeah, well, you know, I mean,
does that
I kind
make
of
you the Archbishop of Melbourne or something.
Yeah, and Father Bob, I was just watching, you know, on television this morning. You know, we're trying to kind of save him in South Melbourne Parish at the moment. But yeah, art's kind of, you know, don't want to sound hokey, but obviously it's my life.
And speaking of your life, apparently one of the turning moments in your life was actually meeting Richard Werrett.
Yeah, that was incredible, actually. And when I first met him, you know, I was a kid from the Gold Coast, and I was in awe. So, you know, just kind of shut up in the corner, I think. It was a social situation and a group of people. Then, however, a job came up at Sydney Theatre Company in 1984, just after they'd opened the Wharf Theatre for an usher. And so I applied for that and got it, which was my first real job in Sydney after leaving the Gold Coast, where I'd been doing my articles with the law firm. So, yeah, I did that. Then I was writing reviews for a little newspaper in Sydney called the Sydney City Express, which morphed into On the Street, the street newspaper up there, and doing reviews for that for about 12 months. Then this job came up to be really a gopher for the directors at Sydney Theatre Company, who were then Robin Nevin as associate director, Richard Werrett as artistic director, and I think Philip Keir was an associate director who went on to publish Rolling Stone in Australia. Excuse me. So, yeah, that was a completely, you know, transforming moment. Richard had enormous faith in me and, you know, promoted me through the company over 10 years from artistic associate, then to literary manager, and then finally I was deputy general manager of the company. So, yeah, I've been so lucky. I've had amazing mentors all through my working life, and I kind of owe everything to them. Great people.
And coincidentally, or maybe not so coincidentally, he's also been a Melbourne Festival artistic director as well.
He sure has. In fact, my first association with Melbourne Festival was actually writing Richard's program brochures. And I got to write the 1992 and 1993 program brochures. And that was my first, even though I'd been going to Sydney Festival on and off, that was my first kind of, you know, experience of really submerging myself in a festival. And I thought, this is amazing. Then in 1995, 2 years later, Anthony Steele from Sydney Festival poached me from Sydney Theatre Company, and that's where my festival life began.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this current program.
Sure.
And I've spotted three that have got opera connected to it.
Yeah.
And sometimes a sketchy connection is all I need.
Sure.
So we've got The Tyranny of Distance with Merlin Quaife, who's an amazing soprano.
Yes.
And yep. Then there's Eurydice Debeul in Peeping Tom, and then, of course, Medea being the biggest opera offering
yes. On
the program. And I know that you've been said to say that opera is a threatened art form.
Yeah.
Be seeing more opera perhaps in future programs, or is this kind of the right balance?
Look, maybe more, sometimes maybe less, only because I try not to be formulaic in terms of, you know, there has to be, you know, one and a half operas, or there has to be, you know, X, Y, or Z. If the work is great and it's there, obviously we'll try really hard to present it to Melbourne. I think what you've identified, though, is really significant, and that's the extent to which so many artists now are tearing down the silo culture of the arts and tearing down the barriers between art forms and really taking from anywhere. And so if operatic lines through a theatre production work and help those artists realise their vision, they will do that. So more and more, I think that there's a kind of, you know, fusion of art forms that we're going to be seeing. And I'm all for it, you know. I kind of, you know, hate the kind of, you know, the silo attitude. I think most young artists these days almost don't even understand how we can, you know, sequester off one art form from another when really they're kind of, you know, taking from every source and being inspired by every source to create their art. So, yeah, I think we'll see more and more of it. If not full opera main stage productions, then certainly opera influences throughout the various other art forms.
Because opera is one of those things that has that amazing ability to touch. I know that when you first saw Ain Adhemar.
Ain Adhemar.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Ain Adhemar, an Arabic opera, which is interesting. Oh, an opera in Arabic for Sydney Festival.
Yeah, I think it was sung in Spanish, but musical influences from Persian culture and all over the world.
Okay.
You're absolutely right. But it was an incredible experience. I mean, with, you know, the word opera, I mean, some people almost use it pejoratively these days. And that's because there is a feeling amongst some people in the community that it's a kind of a heritage art form, which is so not true. That, you know, the operas that inspire me are contemporary operas, and, you know, there are young artists all over the world writing in that form and writing contemporary operas. And probably, you know, my first major experience in terms of contemporary opera and realizing it wasn't museum art was I actually got, by complete coincidence, to see the world premiere production, the Houston production of Nixon in China, which John Adams' piece, which Peter Sellers directed. And it just kind of knocked me for six. And again, I couldn't get that out of my head. Since then, I've kind of, you know, tried to build my own knowledge of the contemporary opera world. And yeah, I'm really keen to present living composers wherever possible. I like to get away from the dead white male kind of, you know, European thread of artistic history. And yeah, I mean, again, with Medea, a living composer, Pascal Dussapen, Ina Demar, Osvaldo Golijov, Love in the Age of Therapy, which I got to co-commission with Melbourne Festival many years ago, Paul Grabowski, Eternity Man, Jonathan Mills, all living composers. And that's what I'm really interested in exploring, the way in which this art form is well and truly being kept alive in the 21st century. And it is absolutely a 21st century art form. And yeah, I mean, just as there are, you know, 70-year-old composers right now, there are 25-year-old composers right now writing opera. And that will happen for all time.
Fool in the Opera on Joy 94.9, and we just heard a track from Ina Demar, the opera that was played at the Adelaide Festival just about a year ago. And the track that we've just heard was called The Third Image, Margherita, Part 5, Doi Mi Sangre, which it's an interesting little opera for me to hear because it has, as you heard, a bit of flamenco guitar in the opera as well. And the Ina Demar actually means Fountain of Tears in Arabic, and it's the first opera that was written by Argentinian composer Osvaldo Golijov, and very sort of, it's got these very interesting mixes between different styles, you know, as Brett Sheehy also pointed out. And I suppose the story is sort of about playwright Federico Garcia Lorca and his lover and muse Catalan actress Margherita Zergu, and it's sort of the story, as I've read it, is quite interesting. But I've had a hunt for a few different reviews online as well, and they haven't all been that quite pleasant. Let's just say that. But what I do know is Dawn Upshaw was the soprano in the particular opera as well, and when it was performed first in Santa Fe. And, well, she's certainly a most amazing opera singer, and you can't go wrong there with Dawn Upshaw in an opera, I've got to say. Now, we're going to continue with the interview with Brett Sheehy, and after the interview as well, there'll be a little bit of a taster for what's coming up next week, but also just what's coming up in the opera world in general, both in Melbourne and for next year's program. So we'll start with Brett, and then we'll continue with the secret surprise. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about this notion of bringing together, you know, a relatively high art form together to a more contemporary setting.
Yes.
And this may seem like a strange question, but it's more to follow up a question that's been asked on a previous show with a living composer, and it was to ask that if the gay world were to have a story done now about it, what would be the important story, do you think? And I ask you because, you know, this is a gay and lesbian radio station. And,
yeah.
And
God, I mean, that's
something that you might, you know,
that's
feel
a PhD thesis, I think. On multiple stories, I think. I mean, you know, I'm not too enamored of ghettoizing gay culture as you know, it's something separate from, you know, the society in which we live. I think that, you know, issues that are affecting gay men and women are those affecting people the world over. That said, I do think the whole issue of civil unions absolutely has to be addressed. And, I mean, I have really strong feelings on the issue. I don't know if you want me to go into them now. But my feeling is, you know, the word marriage can be separated out. I mean, you know, I was raised a Catholic and there was the sacrament of marriage. And I think any religious celebrant who performs a marriage, the people who do that with that celebrant can agree to a religious context for their union. Separate from that, separation of church and state, absolutely the state should recognise the right for civil unions, as it does. I mean, one can go to a registry office and get married, if you're heterosexual, to your partner any time of day. Mm. That's all I ask for. And, you know, how dare anyone tell me, who has been with my partner for 15 years, who is totally devoted to my partner, we've built a life together, we do good in the community, I think. How dare anyone tell me I cannot, in this society, have a union which recognises that relationship? I mean, I pay 50% of all my money in tax, as does he. I don't have children. Yet I'm funding education programs. I don't have a car. I'm funding roadworks. All of those things. I'm happy to do that, you know, obviously. But how dare anyone tell me that in return I'm not allowed to have my partnership with my partner recognised?
I think the City of Melbourne has a registry. Now that you're looking to become more permanent in Melbourne, would you look to register
your when it becomes nationally recognised and it has legal force, then I will. But until then, I'd rather fight the fight. I mean, that said, and back to, you know, your first question about, you know, the issues affecting us. I mean, I think there are multiple things to be addressed. You may know this. There are now, I think, two operas in the world. Angels in America has been turned into an opera. I think HIV is obviously a worldwide issue, not in any way anymore a kind of gay issue. But I suppose I kind of resile from kind of, you know, pigeonholing. I saw Milk the other day for the first time, you know, which was a fabulous film. But, you know, does every film which have gay characters have to have an opera moment? I mean, Philadelphia. I mean, they're gorgeous moments. But, you know, Tom Hanks, spacing out over opera, and then, you know, Harvey spacing out over opera. It's becoming a little bit of a cliche. It's a great art form, and it's an art form for all people, and it can tell stories about all people, including gay people.
Mm. I think that there is a sense of, because it was David Chisholm who I spoke to, and there was a sense from him that there is almost a culture that is lost, that we've lost because of the HIV era.
And, yes.
And same with opera, that, you know, it is a dying art and we're losing a lot of that culture. So a desire to kind of preserve it, pass that story on, is the important thing.
Yeah, look, I think the former is true. I'm not so sure about the latter. I don't think opera is in any way a dying art. Yes, a number of composers died from AIDS. And we certainly lost in terms of just, you know, general culture. I think there was an absolutely palpable loss in the 80s and 90s to world culture with the loss of so many artists to AIDS. But opera, actually, to single out one art form as saying it was more decimated than any other art form, I'm not sure about that. I think just the arts and culture period were, you know, damaged. And so, yeah, now I'm kind of thrilled that we're perhaps on a bit of a renaissance and culture lives again.
Mm. Well, I suppose that it's just a reimagining of that particular culture. Then, in the case of Medea, for example, it's the new version of it, or the reinterpretation of it.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, going along to a Traviata in you know, period costume, I could not be less interested in. Sasha Volz visiting, you know, the Greek myth of Medea in a completely contemporary context and dragging that into the 21st century, I'm totally interested in.
Well, to finish up, I suppose, opening night will be quite exciting for you.
Yeah. Oh, look, I'll be, you know, sick with nerves, but also with excitement. I mean, I just can't wait. I pray the weather holds off.
It's Melbourne.
Yeah, it is Melbourne. In terms of the outdoor work, though, happily we're repeating it over the first four nights. You know, we're hoping for tens of thousands of Melburnians to come along to Trance Express. It's an extraordinary outdoor music theatre event. And indoors, you know, we open Hofe Schechter, we open Medea, Terminus, and so on. There'll be things happening all over the place. It's the first night, you know, that we'll be in the Rumpus Room as well, in the Forum Theatre. So, yeah, look, I can't wait. Every festival, you know, you're kind of on a knife edge with, you know, anticipation and terror. But finally, I'm feeling pretty confident that it'll go well.
That's great. Well, I think we're all anticipating this this new Melbourne festival as well. So best of luck with it.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
Gloria, amor.
You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9, and that's a beautiful little piece there from Tosca, one of my favourite operas, in fact, and I'm really looking forward to not one but two helpings of Tosca this coming, coming 12 months. Melbourne Opera are going to be putting on Tosca very soon, and so next week we'll be having Antoinette Halloran, who was on that particular track there as Tosca, and we're also going to be able to see Tosca coming up next year. If you're in Sydney, you'll be able to see Cheryl Barker as Tosca, and if you're in Melbourne, you'll be able to see Nicole Yule as Tosca. And Rosario Lespina, who was the other voice on that particular track, well, he'll be the Cavaradossi to the Toscas that you've heard. So it's going to be an exciting couple of months ahead. Now, the other thing about September issue is the fact that September is the time when opera companies tend to issue what's coming up in their new year. So we can, in fact, look forward to next year from Opera Australia, for example. There's going to be an Australian opera, Bliss, by Brett Dean, and there'll be La Sonnambula, a bit of a more opera to get you to sleep, I suppose. There'll be Fledermaus. We should hold that for a little bit later, in a couple of minutes, actually. And there'll be The Marriage of Figaro, which we mentioned at the start of the program. An excellent production of Rigoletto and an excellent production of Midsummer Night's Dream will be coming to town as well. And, well, that's on the Opera Australia side. On the Victorian Opera side, there's going to be a whole bunch of exciting productions coming up as well, including concerts of Damnation of Faust. Also, Opera Highlights at the Bowl. So two free concerts coming up. And also just The Bear and Angelique. In fact, what they've called it is it's going to be a year of the year of the woman, or if I'd like to rephrase it, to the year of the birds. You know, birds is a term colloquially used for women, and they'll come relevant in a second. There's the Three Penny Opera by Kurt Weill. There's also Turn of the Screw by Britten, Julius Caesar, and then the other birds. The Parrot Factory and the Cockatoos is coming up as the youth operas that will be offered up next year. So, and by the way, Victorian Opera have just redone their website and it looks absolutely amazing. So I do invite you to check it out. If you'd like to know more about the productions coming up next year, I am going to get off my ass and start blogging again. So you will be able to follow the blog, joy.org.au/thefoolandtheopera. And I imagine as Opera Australia next year, when we have David Hobson and Yvonne Kenny singing De Fledermaus, we'll say, catch us next week, same Fledermaus time, same Fledermaus channel. Thanks for listening to The Fool and the Opera.
Thanks for listening to the Joycast of The Fool and the Opera from Joy 94.9. You can find more Joycasts and the program blog at joy.org.au/The Fool and the Opera. The Fool and the Opera is produced by Dan Vo and Jed Gilbert, thanks to the support of Joy sponsors and members. Please help support it by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.